Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Força Armada assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
You want to be nasty? Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
Aaj jo partiya yahan shor macha rahi hai.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país, tá? Nada, absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome to PALcast, a podcast by the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or PAL. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. PAL is an effort to understand how law can be used to further, as well as to resist, autocratic forces that have been on the rise around the globe. You can learn more about the project at autocratic-legalism.net. PALcast is sponsored by the OU Center for Brazil Studies. Research and sound production for this episode were provided by Ahmed Abdelaziz. My guest today is Oscar Villena. Oscar has training in law and political science, including a Master of Laws from Columbia Law School, and he's a prominent constitutional scholar in Brazil. Besides his academic career, Oscar is a public intellectual and a human rights advocate in that country. He writes for major newspapers, he participates in some leading civic movements, and he came to occupy important positions in NGOs and international organizations that undertake human rights work, such as Conectas Human Rights and the Pro Bono Institute. As you probably remember, I wanted to make this first season of our podcast more conceptual, before delving into the specifics of the countries that we at the PAL Project are researching, Brazil, India, and South Africa. As a result, my plan was to bring Oscar in further down the road in our second season. But as I was reviewing these plans, I thought that listeners would enjoy learning more about how our research is being set up. And this is what makes Oscar both a timely and a helpful guest. As it turns out, Oscar is the dean of the FGV Law School in São Paulo, which is the main local basis for the Brazilian part of our inquiry. So we got to talk a lot about what PAL means to his institution and their academic program. This being said, having the chance to talk to Oscar, I couldn't help but to engage in a conversation about what's happening in Brazil and what law has done to enable or to constrain Jair Bolsonaro. Here's the interview. Oscar Villena, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you and to discuss our project and the Brazilian case at this moment.
There's a lot that I wanted to talk to you about our research endeavor and how that's being handled in Brazil. But it's hard for me not to start this with an overview of current Brazilian events and what they mean to our project. As far as May 2019, you wrote an article on Folha de São Paulo warning that Bolsonaro might be taking the country down the road of autocratic legalism. You actually used this expression. And I found that both meaningful and bold of you, since at the time, Bolsonaro had been for just a few months in the government, and many in the press as well as in academia were still giving him the benefit of the doubt. 2 years later, what is your evaluation of Bolsonaro in power, and is he corresponding to what you predicted?
Well, Fabio, I should confess that I'm not glad that I had anticipated that Bolsonaro would invest on the erosion of Brazilian institutions with the ferocity that he's doing. For those who follow Bolsonaro politics, it was no surprise that the accession to power of an authoritarian character as Bolsonaro, supported by extreme right sectors of the armed forces, including the police, the military, and militias, conservative religious segments, predatory agricultural economic sectors and also ultra-liberal and state actors. This would put enormous pressure over the progressive constitutional democracy that was built after 1988. So it was no surprise. Bolsonaro was there, and he has been in Congress for more than 20 years, always expressing these anti-constitutional ideas. Bolsonaro flourished as a direct consequence of the political crisis that emerged between 2013 and 2018, which had devastating impact over the political institutions and also the political elite. The impeachment of President Dilma is part of this this process. As most new populism around the world, Bolsonaro was elected with an anti-institutional discourse. He also presented himself as the exclusive representative of the good Brazilians. So polarization and conflictual politics became his main instruments to delegitimize his opponents and institutions viewed as a threat to his authoritarian project. So since Bolsonaro did not count with a consolidated coalition, party coalition in Congress, he was not able to promote his authoritarian agenda through major constitutional or legal changes. Therefore, most of his hostility to constitutional values and institutions are channeled to the use and abuse of executive prerogatives, of decrees, budgetary allocation, or strangulation of some institutions, inconsistent nominations. So he normally appoint people that are in contrast with the mission of the institutions. We can see this in the area of racial discrimination, environmental issues, education, etc. And he uses a lot of what we call para-institutional acts, which means he cement the reformation of institutions to decrease with the budget allocation and inconsistent nominations with orders that are given through Twitter to his political discourse that in fact are aiming to neutralize institutions. Therefore, he's trying really to erode the Brazilian democracy, but not from above, from using constitutional amendments or large legal reforms, but from below. His major targets have been indigenous people, environmental issues, Black and youth population, the social periphery that lives in social periphery, social rights, educators, artists, scientists, LGBT community. And he's doing this through this erosion from below, through decrees to nominations to para-institutional acts and small reforms that will have this impact over the progressive project that was established 30 years ago.
I agree 100% with what you say, and we could spend hours here going over these different instances of Bolsonaro's autocratic character. But I wanted to build on something specific that you said, which I think has great theoretical significance. And I find this ironic, since you're getting to this from the viewpoint of a constitutional scholar. You know, lots of other interviewees here are constitutional scholars, and the way they paint autocratic legalism is by highlighting the capacity of the president to pursue and achieve constitutional reform to consolidate power and sideline minorities and opponents. What you're saying is that Bolsonaro was not quite able to do this. And my sense, based on things that you wrote is that that is because of the structure of Brazil's political system, which is a multi-party system where the president is kind of forced to cooperate with the opposition to get things done. There hasn't been, and most likely there will never be, a president with a supermajority in Brazilian Congress. Would you agree with me on this?
Yeah, you are absolutely right. Even though Brazilian institutions had a substantive loss of reputational capital in the last few years with the whole crisis in which the country emerged, Bolsonaro still have to deal with an intricate political system. As you know, Fabio, Brazil adopted in 1988 an extremely consensual system. I'm adopting the categories of Arend Liphardt, the political scientist. Any elected president, it's not easy if he doesn't count with a strong party coalition in Congress and a certain level of political consensus in society. If he doesn't count with it, he will not be able to move his projects on. And this has happened with Cardoso, with Lula, and even with Dilma. When they count with this substantive basis, they were able not just to govern, but to promote reform. When they lose this, what happens with Collor before Dilma and with Dilma, they not just became very, very ineffective as governors, but also they lost their job. They were impeached. So this is a crucial part of political machinery in Brazil, is to build a coalition. Because we adopted a proportional electoral system with large districts, corresponds to states, there is a tendency of proliferation of political parties, and to be effective or successful, the president has to build consensus. Then there is a powerful Supreme Court that have the mandate to guard a very ambitious and extended constitution. And he didn't have the opportunity to pack the court yet. He just nominated one person until this moment. We also need to understand that the Brazil has been a federation for more than 130 years. Even if it's an imperfect federation, the state's elites do have a say in the constitution of the national political will. So presidents have to be in constant engagement with other political and institutional actors to obtain a certain level of consensus necessary to implement his promises and plans. As an anti-system populist, Bolsonaro cannot engage in this kind of day-to-day politics without losing the support of his radical supporters. In this last 2 years, he has followed, in some sense, because of this paradox, three parallel paths, I would say, to deal with the ambiguities of his government. The first one is the ordinary drive, where he places himself as a victim of the political system, depositing the blame of his incompetence on the shoulders of Congress and the judiciary or the state governors, as we have seen during the pandemic. He's always blaming the governors for implementing the scientific measures that are necessary. However, when he feels more vulnerable, mostly as a consequence of judicial investigations, of anti-democratic activities by his followers or by corrupt activities of his own family, then he shifts. He tries to move closer to the political system. A group of parties in the Brazilian Congress that we call rent parties, the Centrão, he tries to accommodate with them to protect him from the impeachment, most of all, and also from a fatal judicial process. However, he keeps open a third path, which is he's constantly forcing the fence. I don't know if the expression works in English as in Portuguese, but with decrease, radicalization of his political discourse, trying to create the sensation of disorder and fear, nominating people that are absolutely in conflict with the mission of the institutions which they should run. So Bolsonaro is, by getting closer in to the military, most of all, his administration has three times the number of militaries of the last administration that already had too many militaries. He's in some sense forcing the fence. He's showing a third path where he could close the system. So I think that his main goal, Fabio, is to disrupt the constitutional democracy projected and erected 30 years ago. However, this same constitutional democracy, given the way its institutions were disposed, as you mentioned, is showing some level of resilience in the face of the hostilities presented by Bolsonaro and his supporters. The key question is if using this language of physics, if the constitution that is showing resilience to authoritarian attacks will resist to a new process, which is the process of a legal authoritarian erosion. So I split these two sides. So I think that the constitution was prepared to attack direct to its core through amendments. And it's very protected. It has a large group of untouchable clauses. It has a strong Supreme Court. However, the way the constitutional system is being attacked is through erosion, to the tried co-optation of some institutions and administrative law reforms and abusive orders. So this is the challenging at this moment.
I'll get back to that. But first, I want to say I find the first part of your argument fascinating because, as you know, the Brazilian multi-party system and the coalitional presidentialism have been demonized in the country as a source of corruption, especially in the context of the Lava Jato investigation. If you read the accusations that public prosecutors made against the former president Lula da Silva, the first 100 pages are more of an indictment of the system rather than any demonstration of his guilt. Given what we are seeing with Bolsonaro and which you're demonstrating in your research, shouldn't we look, as we did before, to the Brazilian political system with more generosity, which doesn't mean that the system cannot and should not be improved, but just that we need to recognize the positives of the system?
Yeah, I do believe so. The constitutional legislators 30 years ago clearly react against our authoritarian immediate past when drafting the 1988 Constitution. And the major goal was to fragment and distribute power among the branches, and through the creation of a multi-party system, a decentralized federation, and numerous of control agencies. It's interesting that since the Constitution is so extended, it touched on so many issues, it legalized most of public policy in Brazil. And it creates new institutions to control if the political system would disregard the Constitution, or it empower several other institutions, as the Supreme Court is the quintessential example of a Supreme Court that was empowered to guard the new constitution against a political system that was distrustful. It also empowered the Ministério Público, the public attorney's office, which received several functions among them to control, to protect the democracy. So the problem, as I noticed in my last book, was that without a mechanism to overcome this fragmentation, which is the creation of large coalitions, the system will be ungovernable. That is one of the problems. And as we know, Fabio, there was several tentatives of creating a more rational political party system. There was an amendment in the end of the 90s, creating a threshold clause, which would forbid political parties that do not have the representation of 5% of the population to become represented in Congress. We model, in some sense, in the German party system. So, but however, this change was considered unconstitutional by the Supreme Court based on the principle of legal pluralism or political pluralism. I think this was the wrongest decision the court gave along this 30 years. So coalitions with time became more fragmented. There were more parties in the political system, and they also became very heterogeneous. So Dilma need to count with a vice president that represents part of this coalition, which was diametrically opposed to her position. She was a very left-winger president with a right-wing vice president. And in Congress, it would reflect on very far left and very far right in the same coalition. So this made it very unstable. So as you said, we have to fix this. And the way to fix is to control the number of parties through several mechanisms, and the main mechanism is a threshold clause that would decrease with time the number of coalitions. So this is the main challenge, to reform the system so to keep its core pluralistic spirit in touch. So I think this is the challenge. We have to fix the political system, but it's very hard to fix it with a president that is so hostile to democracy.
And maybe there are other things to fix, like the logics of Supreme Court deliberations, which is a theme that you also study. But what I think is that it makes a big difference whether we see the Brazilian history post the 1988 constitution as one that's based upon strong democratic foundations, though it may need incremental improvements, and one that's fundamentally corrupted and compromised. I think if we take the latter path, we actually help make the Constitution more vulnerable to its detractors. But let's get back to other points that you made, which is very important. If Bolsonaro has not been able to pass constitutional change and pack courts, he has been constantly attacking Congress and the judiciary. He has also brought to his cabinet a number of military officials and has support from police forces. Is there a chance that he will fail as a legalist autocrat, but then take the role of an old days autocrat, staging a more traditional coup?
As I said earlier, he flirts with this classic authoritarian path constantly. The militarization of the government, as we have seen in Venezuela, his intention in revoking legal limitations on the work of the state police that are thin already, as we know, and his obsession with flexibilization of access to guns, to weaponize his militias, certainly indicates that a strict authoritarian path is on his horizon, even as only a threat at this moment. So here we have to return to the old spectrum of the military, mostly the army, that rounds the Brazilian politics since the beginning of the Republic. As a classical book on the military and politics in Brazil, written by Alfred Stepan in the 80s, shows that the military were not very professionalized during our Republican life. They were, in fact, very politicized, and several sectors of the military were eager to get involved in politics. We count at least five interventions during the Republic, and the last one, which was crystallized in a military authoritarian regime. So after 30 years of democracy, we thought that the military were back to barracks in their constitutional mission to protect the nation against external invaders and its frontiers, etc. But what we have seen in the last 2 years that there are sections of the military, mostly in the army force, that are flirting with politics again. If we take both the Air Forces and the Marine, they are being very loyal to their professional mission and not getting involved in politics. However, the army, by the number of generals presented, not just on the cabinet, I think there are seven of this at the cabinet at this moment, but we count at least 6,000 military in the administration, in top rank administration positions at this. So yes, Fabio, I think we do have also to consider this possibility of, in a situation of instability, of public disorder, of public conflict, that the military will be called back. And just to close this response, we have to understand that each of the Brazilian states do count with a police that is militarized. It's not part of the army, it's not part of the armed forces, but they are militarized. And Bolsonaro, through all his political career in Congress, played the role of a union leader for most of these police. So there is a close identification, both in the ideological terms, but also in cooperative interest between Bolsonaro and the police. So, and this is a source of instability. We had a police riot in the state of Ceará that shows how dangerous is this proximity between Bolsonaro and the state police.
I wanted to shift gears here and ask you more about what you're doing there in the PAL project. As I have told listeners, you had a law school in Brazil that is heavily involved in the project. What gains do you see that an endeavor like this generates in terms of strengthening your academic program?
First of all, an institution that is independent, that has an ambition to produce independent thinking that would contribute to the amelioration of the institutional setting in a country. And the country that I live is in Brazil, and the school that at this moment I have the privilege to be the dean is willing to become the source of a public good for the Brazilian society. As you know, law schools in most countries in Latin America are basically run by professionals, which is not a bad thing in itself. However, if you have interests as a lawyer, as a judge, as a prosecutor, and you do not dedicate your entire life to academic research, you become closer to the interests of your profession than the interests of providing an independent and distanciated analysis of the political system. So FGV Law School, since the beginning, decided that it would count with a large group of academic with full-time dedication and with the aim of producing legal scholar research to really provide a critical perspective on how the legal system is run in Brazil. And I think we are doing this. And at this moment, the challenge is the hostility that is being presented by President and his fellows to the Brazilian rule of law and democracy. So at this point, a school like ours should and have to analyze this threat. And I think what we are gaining immediately is the capacity to read and to provide to Brazilian society where are the main challenges to our democracy, where are the threats, where are the risks, and eventually how we could overcome some of these risks. And there is another aspect, Fabio, if I may just add to it, which is gaining some comparative capacity. As you know, the PAL project is dealing with other countries that are facing not exactly the same kind of threats, but similar threats in a world where authoritarian populism is growing. And so I think that academia and a law school like ours can also serve as a bridge of information so we can rapidly understand the ways and strategies of authoritarian populists against the democratic rule of law. And we can provide the Brazilian experience so other communities around the globe would understand the strategies that are being used here in Brazil.
I think you mentioned several reasons why a project like PAL is valuable and exciting. I think we are producing true global social legal scholarship in those collaborations across the global South and across the North-South divide. But there's also a burden involved. We have to coordinate between different time zones, languages, and academic traditions, for example. What are the challenges that you and your team experience in a project like this, and how do you respond to those?
I think the technological challenges, we are overcoming this with more velocity during this crisis. I think we learn a lot how to organize our life through remote instruments. And obviously, we lose a lot because not everything that has to be said and the ideas, the serendipity of personal encounters favor the creation of hypotheses, the discussion of details that sometimes we lose to more organized encounters that go through this remote machinery. So, however, I think we are learning. We're fast learning. I'm saying humanity is a fast learning beast, and we are really take advantage of the cuts of costs that the new means of communication allowed us, and we are putting more people in dialogue. In circumstances that will be, in normal circumstances, this would be much more costly. We lose a little bit, but we gain in terms of how fast and how many people that we can get involved in this dialogue. So at this moment, I see not many obstacles to a research like this. It's obvious that as the regimes close, as in countries as Hungary, as in countries as Turkey, I've been working a lot with Turkey, and I present this there. Researchers become more threatened by the regime. I think in Brazil, until this moment, we are not fearing this kind of threat, even though you can be blamed as anti-nationalist, anti-government. You get to be exposed on the social media. But this is the times that we are living. And I think we have a group of people that are very courageous and are facing this with responsibility, but also with the sense that it is indispensable that we put our knowledge and the research capacity that we have to understand the nuts and bolts of this enterprise of eroding Brazilian democracy from within.
Just before you go, is there anything our listeners can do to help Brazil or to help the project?
Well, there is many things that can be done by many people, not just in Brazil, but around the globe. I think there is, in one side, the attention about Brazil. I think other people should be writing and about Brazil. Obviously, that Portuguese becomes a barrier for many researchers around the globe. And sometimes we don't see too much attention because it's hard to get the information in a language that is understandable. So in this way, the creation of connection between Brazilian researchers and international researchers, I think, is one of the avenues that PAU would help to bridge. It is very important that the Brazilian academic doesn't feel alone on this battle, but it can count with the academic support of others. The second way, obviously, is financial support. We have several donors that are preoccupied with Brazil, and there are numerous priorities. These donors are, in some sense, overburdened by attacks on indigenous population, attacks on the forest and the environment, the suffering of the Black youth community that is receiving most of this violence that is provided by state agencies. So there are too many priorities on the ground for several funders to face it. So there, sometimes the academics are left out because they are not considered as the most urgent priority. And I tend to disagree in some sense with this because academics can really help to find a way to understand the problems, to put in the right perspective. So even the most practical priorities can be implemented as successful. So yes, it would be very important that those who care about Brazil, those who deal with Brazil, even economically, be supportive of a project like this.
That was Oscar Vilhena. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with your audience. It is, first of all, a pleasure to talk with you. I learn a lot when I talk with you, but also a possibility to reach a large audience of academics that have in common the idea of understanding the nuts and bolts of legal authoritarianism.
If you like our series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have comments or suggestions regarding the series or our project, feel free to contact me at fabio.isaiasilva@ou.edu.